Hello everyone and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers and I'm joined by Gail Schimmel. Hi Gail.
Hi Fiona. How's your writing week been?
You know, it's been a bit of a struggle. I was hoping we would hit yours first, start off on a good note. But I am struggling to find my way into a story. I think it's something I spoke about last week, about a literary work, but that has a commercial edge as well. I'm trying to blend the two. And I've got an idea of a plot. I haven't quite found my way into it yet. The problem with literary stuff is that a chair can't just be a chair. A chair needs to be a symbol as well. And my chairs are all remaining chairs and they refuse to turn into deep and meaningful symbols. So I think what I'm going to do is just start writing and hope that it comes to me. And on Monday, I'm actually going to do it. I'm going to start writing this
book. I think that's a great thing to say. This is the day. This is the day that I'm going to start writing and no more excuses. And I think sometimes a chair can just be a chair.
Well, they're all refusing to turn into something symbolic, so I think it's going to have to stay that
maybe
way.
Maybe your literary commercial work is actually just a commercial work, and maybe that's okay.
Maybe it is. Maybe that's how it'll have to turn out, and maybe I'll start finding symbols along the way. But how's your writing week been?
So, interestingly enough, you've spoken about beginnings, and I want to speak about endings, because one of the things I've had on my plate and still do is that we have finished the latest Katie Gale's first draft. Mm-hmm. And the Katie Gales are murder mysteries. So what happens with a murder mystery is you plant a lot of clues along the way, and then you don't use them all. And we have to go back and we have to get rid of the fake clues that don't go anywhere. And we have to make sure that the clues that are supposed to go somewhere actually make sense. And we have to bring it all together nicely. And to do that, particularly when you have a bad memory, you have to do a very fast read through. You have to have the reader experience to check what's working, what's not working, what pacing is working. And I'm struggling to find the time to do that fast read through. And I'm actually struggling to do a fast read through because I stop and I fiddle. So that's been quite an interesting challenge and I haven't actually managed it yet. So I've got something to do over the weekend because I think that might be the only time I'm going to find the time.
And when you are not doing a fast read-through of your own book, what else are you consuming?
So I am reading a book at the moment called She Lies in Wait by Gytha Lodge. And it is, I presume I got it from, I don't know, it's on my Kindle. It's the beginning of a detective series. I must have either gotten it from listening to a podcast where someone suggested good detective series or a Facebook post or something, something like that. Someone who said this is a good series and I'm enjoying it greatly. But the thing that's interesting me about it is I'm reading it because, as you know, I just read the latest Robert Galbraith, which is a massive fat physical book. And I have a number of other physical books in my to be read pile that I want to read quite badly. I needed a Kindle book. I needed it's become so much part of my reading pleasure. I needed that book that isn't heavy in my hand because I actually think I've done something to my hand with Robert Galbraith. And I needed that experience of a Kindle book to almost palate cleanse before my next physical book.
Interesting, interesting. I've moved over almost entirely to Kindle at the moment, and I find it difficult to go back to print.
I think that's the thing. It's unusual for me to have such a big pile of physical books, and it's been weird. So what are you reading and where?
I have been watching. I want to talk about something I've been watching because it was recommended to me initially by Colleen Higgs of Majaji Books. She said, you must watch The Bear. It's on Disney and it's amazing. And that was a few months ago. And then we interviewed Sven Axelrad and he also mentioned it. So I figured the universe was trying to tell me something. So we started watching The Bear, which has also just cleaned up at the Emmy Awards, Best Scripted Comedy. And it is so interesting because it's very hard to classify it as a comedy. It has some light comic moments, but it's also a kind of family drama. It's interesting to me that there's something that is finding mainstream recognition that is straddling genres in such a groundbreaking way. It's about a Michelin-starred chef who returns to Chicago to take over his family's sandwich business. They basically sell takeaway sandwiches. And he tries to bring in everything he learned from these top French restaurants into this takeaway sandwich place. And it's about all the people who work there. The performances are extraordinary. The tension, I think Sven mentioned, you know, if you've ever worked in restaurants, you're so aware of the tension and the pace and the almost becomes too much at times. It kind of takes your breath away. But it's really interesting. It's really excellent. And if anyone else has watched it and wants to comment, I'd love to hear what they think about it. But our guest today is also someone who straddles genres, who occasionally takes your breath away with the things she writes. And we're looking forward to getting into it with her. Our guest today is Diane Auerbach. Diane is the author of Gardening at Night, which won the Commonwealth Prize. She was also shortlisted for the Kane Prize for a short story. She's the author of Cabin Fever, Home Remedies, and with Alex Latimer, writing as Frank Owen. She's the author of the dystopian novel South and its sequel North. And most recently, and very excitingly, Diane has a new collection of short stories out with Caravan Press called Inside Your Body, There Are Flowers. I'm only hitting the highlights of her career. There is much more. But Diane, we so much appreciate your time. Hello and welcome.
Hi, guys. It's so nice to see you and hear you.
It's so exciting having you, and it's so exciting generally that we can interview people in Cape Town these days, and you are a really, really big treat for us. So we're going to start by asking you immediately how your writing week has been.
You know, that is an old person's question, because those of us with small children have not had writing weeks. We've had everything else flipping weeks, and with writing in the kind of interstitial spaces where someone isn't asking you to do something that they should already know how to do. But I'm not bitter. I'm actually involved in quite a lot of stuff at the moment. Caravan is having its festival, which is in March. It's coming up.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's all short stories, mm-hmm. which is great. Because if you don't like it, you can just walk away. Karina says they're like affairs instead of marriage. But
I love that.
I don't know. You'll have to be the judge of that. Yeah, and Sat Fishuk Library, which is such a fantastic kind of low-key community-oriented venue. Everyone's welcome. It's open. And the focus is on writers who want to write, writers who debuted a collection, and then established writers who have obviously written a collection and are not seeing any money from it. So it's something for everybody.
Definitely the not seeing any money part, something that most of us can relate to.
Yeah, writing is a posh hobby, right?
So what does your posh hobby look like when you are in the midst of it?
I'm actually working on something at the moment. I've just put together a manuscript of the horrendous things my children have said to me over their entire lifetimes. It's quite a lot of blackmail material there. And they're old enough now to consent meaningfully to kind of being in a more public space. And it's just been like such a great thing to do. It's quite a large manuscript. It's about 23,000-24,000 words.
Wow.
Which is like a third of a novel. And I love that it's real and that it links to quite serious issues. But at the same time, it's cryingly funny.
Is it going to be like a long one of your Facebook posts?
Yes, it is those things. And I was using it initially to practice dialogue. I was kind of in the middle of child rearing chaos and other work as well. Because I write textbooks for a living. That's where my actual money comes from. And this was just stuff that I did to keep my hand in, to keep practicing. And also, the thing is that if you get distracted by life, you lose the knack of looking at things properly.
Your work is founded in domestic reality, and I wanted to ask how much it is inspired by watching life and watching your family.
Well, writers are rejects, right? They are people who've spent their childhoods not participating, being the person who was picked last for the team, and kind of making a habit of observing the people around them. I mean, it's not a healthy way to grow up. It's useful. It is useful. And that's why people who haven't had childhood trauma have a harder time writing, because they have less material to work with.
So it is our duty. Yeah, but it is our duty as parents to traumatize our children so they have something to write about.
But that's what I want to talk about. We talk about domestic as if it's inferior or smaller than the greater things in the world, politics or philosophy or economics. But the thing is that it's just because women are doing it.
Mm.
And it's the fundamental stuff. It's the stuff that if you don't do that, the other things can't happen. And it's just, it's because it's not remunerated or respected. But it's also the fundamental stuff. So you can link it to all kinds of intersectionality, especially feminism and all that stuff, but you don't have to. There are many levels to it all the time.
Would you say that writing about domesticity is a way of giving it the respect it deserves?
It depends what you're writing about.
What you write about it, Diane.
What I write about. It's tough. Sometimes you're writing about something because you need to get over the hairball it is in your throat.
Mm-hmm.
And once you've got up, you've come to terms with what it actually is and you can walk away. Wrestling with things that you haven't, or that are fascinating, or that you haven't dealt with. It doesn't have to be a traumatic thing or a bad thing. It's just something that's interesting to you, so you keep writing about it.
I wanted to pick up on that question that Gail raised of how much of your writing is based on real life. And it does seem to me to kind of straddle that area between memoir and fiction. And I noticed these days they have a word for it, which is biofiction, which I think is fiction informed by the biographical details of someone's life. But you were doing it very early on, it seems, you know. For all I know, it could all be complete fiction, but I don't think so. I think it is inspired by the biographical details of your life. As I was sort of rereading Gardening at Night and Home Remedies and some of the stories in Cabin Fever, were you kind of consciously straddling memoir and fiction, and were you kind of aware that you were carving a new genre while you were at it?
Wow. So that's interesting. I think some of that is marketing spiel. And I think all writers do it. And people who tell you that they aren't doing it are lying. And sometimes there are legal reasons. That's why they tell you to wait until everyone's dead. But I think the rule is if it happened to you, it's your story and you're allowed to tell your version of it. So yes, my stuff is real, mostly. The weirdest stuff is real, actually. And I've had one or two, repercussions where someone's tried to sue me or threatened to sue me. So there's stories for telling and stories for selling. And everyone has a story to tell. Whether they tell it well enough to sell is a whole other story.
Mm-hmm.
And often you feel once you've reached the end of your manuscript, X many drafts, that, yay, you've accomplished this huge thing, but you're actually, if you're going to enter the publishing universe, you're only at the beginning of a very difficult, very soul-destroying journey where you've got to shake your ass quite a lot. And part of the disappointment and heartbreak of being a writer is that the quality of your writing doesn't really matter as long as you have an amazing marketing team behind you. As long as you're about a 6 or a 7 out of 10, you can get by.
That's a very interesting observation. I'm tempted to go down that road, but I want us to first, what you haven't told us is and where we normally start, but we plunged into the deep stuff with you immediately, is how you came to be a writer. Like what did you start out being? Because very few people start out being writers. And how did you come to writing?
Look, I think there are familial aptitudes, just like there are good singing voices in families, or people have a creative bent artistically. I think you have a writing aptitude. And then it depends whether you want to do it. And then it depends whether you work very hard at doing it. So my dad liked to write. And part of my writing now is legacy stuff, where I'm writing about him or about things that he wanted to write about and couldn't. So writing is often quite a healing process for me. Once I've finished a story, and if I've cried while I've written it, I know that it's done its work. And what I want is to make other people cry when they read it. And not because my grammar is terrible, but because it's spoken to them in some meaningful way, that it's connected with them. Because what else is there? It's you talking to somebody else, and you have a shared experience.
So, Diane, I'm so curious to know how old you were when you were writing Gardening at Night.
I was in my early 20s.
Wow.
Yeah, I was teaching. I was a full-time teacher, so part of it was mental health stuff. I didn't understand that at the time, but you have to carve out the space for yourself, otherwise you can't give to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And also horrendous boyfriends, really bad, awful people. I think there's a sense, and I know I'm speaking generalizations here, but women feel like they have to earn love. Whereas men feel like they're entitled to it or they deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in our 20s, it's such a terrible time because you're trying to find the right job and the right place to live and the right partner and all these things at once. And your body hormonally is doing these very terrible things to you. So your decisions, my decisions weren't great for me.
Because, you know, writing's one of those careers, maybe a bit like psychology, where people believe that, you know, having a kind of rich body of life experience really contributes to it. But I think there is something very special that young people who are articulate and do have the discipline to actually produce a manuscript have to contribute, that perhaps, you know, me in my 50s, I might not have that anymore. And I was reading over your manuscript and trying to put my finger on what it was. And I think that you articulated it. You said it's that time in your life when there's great flux. There are bad decisions. There are people moving in and out of your life, many of them contributing negative experiences. What is that animating force that lets a young person produce a prize-winning novel?
Well, I think a lot of people write because they have to. They feel compelled to, that if they don't get this thing out of them, it's going to curdle. So there was some of that. But I was also very conscious of this kind of passing away of a time. Mm. I mean, that was an amazing time to be. I was exactly the right age for the changes that were happening sociopolitically. There was this kind of efflorescence of culture, music and clothes and interactions and literature. And that's kind of fallen away now. We've gone back to these weird kind of racial, social binaries. And I was looking at some old Laugh It Off annuals and how, like, nuts they are. They're insane, but they're so full of life. So that was definitely part of it. But Kimberly wasn't, for me, I'd never read anything about Kimberly that in the same way. And I wanted to talk about this whole. And obviously it's a metaphor for so many other things, but actually, literally, it's an amazing thing.
I want to ask you another question about writing young versus writing older. And that is, you know, as you said, we went through a big period of change and our sensitivities have changed completely. Do you find the way that you're approaching writing, the sensitivities we have now compared to the sensitivities when you started writing? And I say this with a book about to be republished that I need to read because I need to see if I was got things wrong then that I'd like to get right now. Are you feeling that same pressure?
Mm. Even just from looking at the early posts for this manuscript that I'm working on, which, by the way, has a name. It's called Tears Before Bedtime. The stuff that I was writing right at the beginning, we often talk about fat people. Like, it's something that children remark on all the time. And it's hard to explain to a child why it's not okay to talk about somebody's appearance. But there's a rule, right? If you can't change it in 5 seconds, you don't need to remark on it. So there's an evolution at the That's the rule. You can say to somebody, that's a great dress, or don't talk about hair.
So you can say
those shoes are amazing.
But you can say you've got some lipstick on your teeth because they can change that in 5 seconds.
You can say what you like about somebody, but they're also not asking for your opinion. So it's often a stranger. Like you'll be walking past somebody and you'll go, why don't you smile more? whatever your shtick is. Hey, baby. And it's kind of linked to those ideas about what access do we have to other people? What right do we have to comment on the way they present themselves? And it's a difficult one because then you're edging into other territory. And what do you do when you're trying to get to know somebody and you have a one-on-one interaction with them? So it's a tricky one to explain kind of socioculturally and linguistically. What is it okay to say to somebody? And you can have all the best intentions in the world, but don't ask a black person if you can touch their hair. Just don't. And the responsibility is on each of us to work out what those rules are. And I think there's a lot of kind of boomer resistance to that. You know, they should know I'm not trying to be offensive.
Yeah.
Whatever. But no, be better. Don't talk about fat people.
I'm so curious regarding tears before bedtime. You know, the original posts, it was a kind of exercise in microblogging. You put them up on Facebook without comment, and then people would look at them and they would comment or react or whatever. And now you're putting this collection together. Are they also just standing alone in chronological order without comment, or are you providing commentary or context on these little posts?
It's a tough one. I had this plan that I was going to organize thematically and then really get on my soapbox about neurodivergence and sexuality and food. And I just thought, that is not the way, Diane. Just sit down. So I'm doing it chronologically, and mm-hmm. they're standalone. I have a small introduction, which hopefully will head off a few questions, like, why did you have children? You seem to be having a real problem with this. What? Why? Why did you do this to yourself? And that sort of thing. But I don't want to dox them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I want the things that they say not to be invasive of their privacy. So it's kind of a snapshot of their development, but also, like, monetizing your children is horrendous. Or people who have blogs. Now, I really hope this is not you guys. No. People who have blogs by dog kind of thing, where they are speaking in the voice of the dog. It's a bit, it's hard to read. Or people who think that their children can do no wrong and are the most special children who've ever been. And look at this trophy my child has won. These are my genes. Look at my genes. Look at me. I don't want to do that.
Diane, I want to talk in some detail, and I've got a feeling that Fiona will too, about short stories and really a little bit maybe of advice about short stories for those of us who struggle with it a bit. And I think the first thing I want to know is, when you have an idea, when like that little piece of something that comes to a writer comes to your head, how do you know whether this is the material for a short story or this is the material for a long novel?
It really does depend on the person. Short stories are the way to go if you don't have a lot of headspace. I mean, since COVID, I've had COVID a lot. Even though I'm vaccinated, get vaccinated, I've had neurological damage. So my memory is shot, especially for nouns and proper nouns. So I'm not as sharp as I was. I think what it did for a lot of, especially women of a certain age, and this, I mean, there are studies that it pushed us into menopause early. So we basically aged, COVID aged a lot of women 10 years. So time is an issue. That's one thing. The second thing is that sometimes it's just a record of incident. A small thing happened. You don't want to spend too much time talking about what it means and the metaphorical value of it, et cetera, et cetera. It's just a ha-ha, funny ha-ha and funny peculiar. And then if you have something that doesn't go away, So the manuscript that I'm really trying to write at the moment is my Owl House book, which has been in the works for many, many, many years. I mean, I was writing about it in Gardening at Night. So that's something that won't go away for me. But writing is, it's like magic in the sense that you shouldn't look backstage. Appreciate the trick for what it is and do it as long as you can do it, but don't try to work out how it works, because then it sucks the joy out of it. And people need to be honest to themselves about why they're writing, what they want from it. Is it a private thing? Is it going to be a public thing? And are they going to try and make a career out of it, which is incredibly difficult.
Now, you see, on this podcast, all we do is open the kimono and peek behind the curtains and interrogate the process and sort of try and suck all the magic and joy out of it.
You're neurodivergent, guys. It works differently to other people's, and you found a way to channel it into something beautiful and useful. And if you didn't, maybe you'd be doing something else beautiful and useful. But also, maybe you'd be bitter and useless, and that's also an option.
Or doing something mundane and boring, and that's also useful to the world.
Yes, and there's value. You know, the thing that I'm most interested in when I meet somebody, especially women, is I want to know what they do. Like, what is their thing? Because that's really interesting to me. I feel like the sexual stuff and whatever, you go through many iterations of that in your life, and it's fairly similar for everybody. The dynamics of generally, unless you're into some hardcore stuff, in which case I don't want to have that conversation with you anyway. But work is the thing. Work with a capital W. And it doesn't have to be something fancy or writing or something that's publicly acknowledged. Doing the work of the home is important because things, you vibrate out from that.
So a lot of your work, your own single-authored work, is very grounded and located in South Africa and in particular settings in South Africa, often rooted in domesticity, as you've mentioned. And then you did this kind of switch where you were writing as Frank Owen with Alex Latimer, two novels set in a dystopian imagined version of the United States of America, where the twist, the thing that happened, took place, I think, in the 1960s, and the world went off in a different direction. What was that like? I have so many questions about it. First of all, how did you and Alex work together? How did you divide up the writing? Because I, with the best will in the world, I haven't quite been able to figure out, oh, this is a Diane-authored chapter, that's an Alex-authored chapter. They very blended. So how exactly did you do that? We really want you to open the kimono now.
Ooh! Well, I've got to tell you, Alex was not my first choice. Okay. I asked Kate White if she wanted to do it, because I love her historical stuff. Mm-hmm. And she turned me down.
Oh, dear.
So Alex got hold of me because we shared a publisher, Penguin South Africa, at that point. And then I launched his first novel. And then we were just talking literally about how do you make money out of this gig? And so we tried to reverse engineer it, which we shouldn't have done, and it didn't work. And it was an incredibly disappointing experience, especially because we predicted a whole lot of stuff that actually happened. The wall, Trump, COVID, the works, baby. And can I just tell you, the cure's in those novels too, but nobody wants to read them. So, We didn't choose chapters or characters. We talked a lot about a lot of coffee, about what was going to happen, about outlines. And then he's an illustrator as well, so he would actually do little pictures, and that really helps. They're kind of, what's that thing you do in movies where you draw little blocks of
pictures? Storyboard.
There you go. That. But we also, like, now, looking back, I don't know how we did it. And I also can't tell what I wrote and what he wrote. His stuff is a bit more whack.
So I'm fascinated by this because I co-write a lot, and we have a lead writer and who's not me. Kate is our lead writer, and then I kind of come behind and we plot together. But I cannot imagine. Just talk us through, how do you write a book at once together if you don't have a lead writer? Make me understand.
Well, I think we're quite competitive with each other, and that's part of it. Sarah Lotz and Louis Greenberg were the same thing. They'd send each other chapters, then try to get the characters into trouble, yes, then force the other one to solve. Yeah, we didn't really do it like that. I don't know. It helps if you are used to overwriting, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I struggle with imagining universes from scratch. So I'm quite journalistic. I like to have something to attach it to, some kind of framework. And then I can fill that in lyrically.
Did you go, I will write chapter 1 to 3, and then you will write chapter 4 and 5, and then we will see where we are?
No. We would just write, say, we try and get to 1,000 words and then email it to the other one. Okay. And they were free to tinker with it and then write the next section. So, I mean, as you know, it's good to have that pressure.
Yeah,
and knowing that someone is waiting for you to deliver, I mean, I struggle with that as well. There's no deadline for this Owl House book, so I'm like, well, it happens when it happens. But I think as you get older, you get more organized, you get more rigorous, and that's a good thing. It doesn't mean that you get less creative. It just means that you don't waste energy.
And I'm interested as well, again, kind of from my own co-writing, I thought I would hate it and I love it. How did you find that aspect?
It really kind of kneecaps you for solo writing afterwards.
Mm.
Mm. I found it really hard to motivate myself to get back into writing. And that's partly why the short stories happened. I was like, I can't actually face another novel at this point. I'm just going to write something small and then we'll see where it goes.
Interesting.
So I wrote a virus book myself, and South and North are kind of premised on, part of the idea is that there are these rampant souped up viruses kind of spreading on the wind. Do you think that the appetite for virus books is reduced? Are we ever going to see another virus book, or are they over for now?
So much of publishing is a gamble. It's like the stock markets. People talk a good game and they want to tell you they know how things work and the trend, and this is trend. You know, they don't. Sometimes there's a hit and sometimes there isn't. And what I also don't really understand about publishers in terms of marketing is that they pour all this money into the first book that you have with them, and then you're kind of left dangling in the breeze for your second, third, fourth novels. Like, surely you've created this kind of juggernaut. How does it make financial sense not to keep supporting it? I mean, I know some huge established writers overseas right now are really struggling with it, having to knock on doors and start all over again. It's bizarre. It's like a COVID, there was some weird reset. So predicting content, I think it's trying to commercialize something is fine, but then you have to understand what kind of writing you're involved in. It's kind of like screenwriting. And so what I've wanted to do with this book, and why I feel okay defending it, this book of short stories, is that it's something that I care about.
Mm.
And I'm right about this. And I'm going to tell people. So having a thing that you really care about and being prepared to defend it is a huge part of that. That sincerity.
Yes.
You call it authenticity, but that's, people can fake that. But you're writing for yourself, that you want to be proud of this thing. It's a legacy thing. And when you're gone, this artifact is here.
I think that's so true. In fact, I'm making a note of it.
What is the state of short story publishing in South Africa at the moment? Is it the small boutique presses that are doing it? Is there still space for short stories with the big publishers?
Big publishers suck.
You heard it here first.
They are cutting off all the writers, even the really big, like huge award-winning writers at this point in terms of literature production. And they're really focusing on money. So it's like sports biographies and how-to things. And that's great. Good for them. But that's not what I'm interested in. And I don't want to be attached to that sort of mercenary bullshit. So, I mean, there are problems with indie presses, of course, mainly because it's usually one woman. There are like 7 women, guys, in this country that are holding up the entire continent on their shoulders. Like, and as individuals, it's amazing that they are still walking around and compass mentis. So having said that, there are a number of very good, very competent indie presses, and they are pumping out short story collections. I don't know how they are subsidizing them. I'm very glad that they exist. Yeah.
And Fiona has actually stolen my question with that, because I wanted to ask you, if someone's got a short story or a collection of short stories and they want to get it published, what is your advice to them? How do you go about getting your short story collection published? I will be taking notes.
Look, it depends what you have. If you are a young person and you have a couple of stories, you want to be submitting to competitions. And if you're, you know, decent, you'll be noticed and they'll help you do the things you want to do. Again, it depends. And so much of publishing is about timing. So if you obviously are going to bookstores and looking at what people are publishing, and then you're obviously going to the website of the publisher you think is most likely to publish your genre, obviously, and then sending it where you think it's most likely to land. There's no shortcuts.
Yeah. And short stories are challenging because they're not a thing, you know, if you've got a novel that nobody's taking, you can always self-publish. But self-publishing one short story, I suppose you could do it on a website.
I feel like there's so many opportunities for this. You could make a beautiful thing. You could make a chapbook. You could get it illustrated. If you've got money to throw at it, obviously. You don't have to go the traditional route. You can do whatever you want. You just need a barcode, and it's easy to get a barcode. Google how to get a barcode. I mean, I think there's also a certain amount of laziness where people come to you with a story and want you to do the admin.
Yeah.
But I have children, so I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
And if they want it to be successful, they will. Having said that, there's plenty of mediocre stuff that's being published all the time. It's about timing and luck and marketing.
So your latest collection of short stories, Inside Your Body, There Are Flowers. Can you tell us what sort of was the momentum behind it? At what stage did you know, okay, I've got a collection here that's ready to be published? Was there a thematic link between the stories? Is it a reflection of your time of life? Is it as kind of bio-fictional as some of your other collections? Can you just tell us a bit about it? Because it is newly out and it's a publishing event to have a new Diane Auerbach out.
Yeah, look, it's revenge, right? All those people who were mean to me when I was growing up, now they're going to suffer. No, I jest. But some of them are revenge stories. You'd have to read them to find out which ones, though. Yeah, okay, so I'm very concerned with the body. And what COVID did for a lot of people was highlighted how the immune system works.
Mm-hmm.
Like your mind is a precious thing. So if you've ever had any kind of disease, cancer is a biggie. Which is a whole lot of things. It's like a an umbrella word for all sorts of illnesses. You understand what it's like to manage that on a daily basis. Like you're alive and you're healthy, but you have to be careful. So that story is about what health is. What would it look like? It's hard to explain, hey, in prose.
You can say it in a poem if you want.
I have one. You joke. I have a book of haiku. If you're not careful, it's coming out. As women especially, and it's changing now, but for a long time. And Christianity has a lot to do with this, the sense that you're dirty. That your body's gross, and you have to clean it and cover it up, and only expose it to one person in this specific way, and any alternative is against the Lord. And it's literally the word unclean. And it's a terrible way to think about your body, your poor body, that is just trying to help you, like do all the things that you're doing. So imagining that inside your body, there are beautiful things in a system that works, in a beautiful system that works, in a way it's difficult to explain. It's an ecosystem, I guess. It's a cosmos. It's a garden. And it's a very old idea.
And how does one go from this idea to a set of short stories?
Well, it came up when I was trying to find a title for them. I was like, how do I find one title that sums up everything that's going on in this collection? So there's some childhood stories, there's some early womanhood stories, and there's some crone stories. And sometimes there's a phrase that leaps out at you, and it makes sense to you and you care about it, and that's the title. That's what happened here.
I think that's what's lovely about, not that I have ever had the experience naming a short story collection over a novel, is that you can go with that feeling title rather than this is what the novel is about title.
I mean, when you talk about feeling, are you talking about intuition?
More that you can choose a title that sums up the feeling of all the stories rather than the, you know, when you name a novel, it's got to have some sort of connection to the novel. You can't just randomly name a novel based on the feelings you were having while you were writing it.
I don't know.
Okay, I'm going to tell my publisher we're changing my next novels.
I think one of the rules is don't have ing.
I'm quickly doing an audit.
No, don't, because there are lots of books that do. A quite famous South African series, actually. And that's so you can defy the rule. No, you can defy the rule and get away with it. But you've got to be confident in how you do it. Like, that's the thing. Like, we all know what the rules are now. But you decide whether you're going to go along with it or whether you're going to... No.
I'm safe on the ING. Are you safe on the ING, Fiona?
Gail, I hate to break it to you, but you are not safe on the ING. I'm thinking of Chasing Marion.
Oh, Chasing Marion. Oh, I'm not safe. Damn it. Sorry, Diane.
That was the case. No, that was the example I gave as the anomaly, the exception to the rule. So you know what the rule is, and you've chosen to go the other way.
Had no idea there was a rule.
Diane, where can people get hold of your latest collection? Because it doesn't seem to be available electronically yet. Is that going to change? And people who do want to read it, where should they go? What should their first port of call be?
It should be in brick-and-mortar bookstores. Indie bookshops should have it. Mm-hmm. And feel free to harass the airport. Because I feel strongly they should stock it.
Yes.
Keep going in and keep asking. So brick and mortar guys, I think Exclusives has it. But we support the indies. Shame. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to squeeze an ebook out of Caravan, but there's, one person doing many, many, many difficult things well.
Absolutely.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
So can you tell us what you have been reading or listening to or watching lately that has filled up your creative well or made some kind of an impression on you?
Yes, I can. I made a list. Firstly, we need to just talk about Sarah Lotz's book, Impossible.
Yes. Oh, loved that book.
Loved it.
It is a perfect artifact. There's nothing wrong with that book. It hits every note perfectly, and it's an easy read. She deals with something mind-bogglingly difficult, because love is. It's a difficult thing to think about. And then add the SF stuff. Bizarre. Beautiful book. I just read a biography called Agatha Christie. I can't remember the author, but it was beautifully written. And it's, again, someone who's a veteran biographer. And, I mean, for a long time, the thing was not to say I when you were dealing with any other writer, but I kind of like it when there's some kind of authorial insertion there. If the person's interesting and a good writer. And it's quite chatty, and so fascinating. Like, she's really, really done her research and got, people to talk to her and seen letters that other people haven't. And it's so kind and such a compassionate look without lying about how she behaved. And then Elton Baikis, which is, by Lester Walbrich, which I think is just amazing. It is perfectly pitched, absolutely poetic, and it's about a serial killer. I mean, it doesn't get better than that. It should be winning everything. Okay, and then in terms of, I do watch a lot of TV, but I'm not going to tell you what.
Don't judge you at all. We are big believers that you can absorb your story however you want.
Okay, I do watch like cozy killer murder British.
I'm happy to hear that. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, Gail writes those stories.
I know. Good. I love the production design. I don't know, people care about these things. And then Australian TV. There's a series called Fisk.
Oh, we love it.
Which is about it. I love it. But also, I think one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life was the Tully series. Tully's Wedding Diary, all that stuff.
Oh, yes. Brilliant.
Hilarious. Like, beyond funny.
Yeah.
And it's been very interesting seeing how it's affected my daughter. Like, it's helped her to judge people based on how they talk and what they talk about, because she sees what a horrible individual Tully is. It's been very interesting in an anthropological way. And then, lastly, the listening thing. I just saw the Tracy Chapman, Luke Combs Grammy performance.
Magnificent.
And I saw it on Reddit, which is where I spend a lot of my time. And the comments from people were they really show you why art is important. And everyone just saying, I heard the song 20 years ago and it means something completely different to me now. And I feel like I understand it now with my heart. Mm. Before I understood it with my head. Now I really understand it. And obviously it's a very sad song, but it's also the fact that someone's singing about it is an act of hope. It's an act of resistance. It's an incredibly complex thing. And she obviously is just an incarnation of light. Yeah.
Well, Diane, we hope that everyone checks out Inside Your Body, There Are Flowers, which is out now from Caravan Press. And we are greatly looking forward to Tears Before Bedtime. Is that going to be a Caravan Press publication?
No, that's with a tattoo press, which is Joanne Hitchens. She does the Short Shop Stories Award. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so we'll see.
And Mother's Day. I'm going to be waiting for the Owl House book. So best you sit down and start writing. And none of this, I don't have a deadline rubbish from you. Thank you.
Don't you want to co-write it? Come on, you guys. All three of us. It'll be fun.
But we'll give you such strict deadlines that you'd cry.
Oh, bring it. Bring it on.
Diane, we also hope that people check out your backlist, which is available electronically, which is lovely to see. But thank you so much for your time. This has been absolutely delightful.
Thank you.
Thank you, both of you.
Gail, while Diane was talking, I saw you making a note with the word hairball in it. What did you want to tell us about hairballs?
Fiona, you have caught me out in a brain foggy moment. I have got no idea why I wrote down hairball. I wrote hairball in throat, and I think Diane was talking about a story being stuck in your throat and needing to cough it up. So I was taken with that, because I think that is something, particularly with short stories, that happens, that you suddenly overwhelmed. I know the few short stories I've written, I write them like I'm in some sort of panic mode, like the whole thing needs to come out of me, I suppose, like a hairball stuck in my throat.
Yeah.
I was also very taken by her saying that there are stories for telling and stories for selling.
Oh, interesting.
I like that. It may, you know, sometimes you think you've got a great idea, and it's not an idea that's going to turn into a commercial thing that you can sell, but maybe it's a story you need to tell. So that's something I want to think about a bit more. It made an impression on me. What about you, Fiona? What have you written in your notes?
Well, I think what I've written is connected to the hairball point, which is she was talking about writing as therapy, about healing yourself or your past by writing about it, a story that needs to come out of you and needs to go on the page so that you can heal. And she was kind of speculating that we are all the kids who were chosen last for the team, the ones who watched life going on rather than participating in it. And she also made a case for us all being neurodivergent in some way, which is also interesting. My problem is that I often feel self-indulgent when I know I am medicating myself by writing this thing. I almost tell myself to stop and say, no, this is your own personal nonsense. Deal with it in your own time. The reader doesn't want to see that. But a lot of Diane's writing has been, you know, healing the inner child, dealing with the childhood stuff, dealing with current traumas, dealing with things that make her mad or make her sad. And it's produced such brilliant writing that I think I need to think about that and maybe be a bit bolder about putting my own trauma on the page.
It's interesting because I can't. I actively tried to, in my latest book, I needed to add a plot thing. And I thought, well, let me draw on X experience, which I'm not going to name. And I started it and I couldn't. It wasn't therapeutic for me. It was traumatic for me.
Right.
I pulled back a lot. I left a tiny piece of it in, but I pulled back a lot. Maybe it is also that feeling that it's self-indulgent. Maybe I also have to look at that and try and mind myself a bit better.
Yeah. When I was writing The School Gates, I realized that I was taking not trauma, but anger and indignation at a certain situation and putting it on the page. And I had to write and rewrite that book so many times to get it into a form that would be interesting for the audience and not just my own way of kind of working out my issues in writing.
And you know, when you say that, I'm thinking, well, am I even telling the truth? Because maybe my book that's coming out soon, maybe there is a therapeutic element because there is an anger element. And maybe when we do the therapeutic thing, often it's very deeply hidden in the character. You think you're writing about the character, but actually you're writing about yourself.
Well, that's what Diane said. She said, we all do it. We all write about our own lives. We put our own stuff on the page, even if we're pretending that we're not doing it. Gail, have you got writing advice for us this week?
I feel like we've given some very good writing advice already that we've now gleaned. But what I wanted to talk about briefly is to write notes to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're writing, don't trust, maybe this is just me, but don't trust your memory. You're going to forget that character, even though you think they're the best character you've ever invented. You're going to forget their names in a few days. Keep notes on things like how old is the person when, what do they look like, what is their name, where did you bring them in, why. You know, work with some notes, even if it's just a scribble spider diagram or whatever works for your brain. But so often when I fail to write down something, I regret it so badly. What about your advice this week?
I think it connects to what I was saying earlier about my decision just to start writing this book That is by no means fully cooked in my head yet. It's not ready. It's not fully conceived. I don't quite know where it's going. But I think that the process of writing will make a lot of things clear to me. So I'm going to just start writing, and I hope that our audience can find that useful as well. And if anyone has been struck by what Diane said, if you've read her work and been intrigued by it, particularly the latest collection, In Your Body, There Are Flowers, please get in touch with us. We're on all social media and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.